Historian, entrepreneur, and author Itai Tenenbaum is your guide for a behind-the-scenes tour of Israeli society and objective analysis of the key issues of the day for anyone who wants a deep and authentic look inside Israel.
My name is Itai Tenenbaum. I am both an Israeli and an American. Born in Tel Aviv, moved to the United States at the age of 11, and lived in the Washington, D.C. area. At 18, I returned to Israel, served in the Israeli Defense Forces, mainly as a tank commander. I participated in the First Lebanon War in the 1980s, and for years inside Gaza, in my month-a-year reserve duty. I run boutique tours to Israel, and of course, this podcast, Inside Israel. On March 25th, the United Nations Security Council voted in favor of a proposed resolution that included a demand for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire during the month of Ramadan and for the immediate and unconditional release of the Israeli hostages. 14 countries supported this resolution. The United States abstained, but the U.S. didn't veto it, and the proposal passed to the sound of applause in the Security Council. Are there ramifications for Israel? Well, first of all, it is not a binding decision. They cannot force Israel to stop the war. But it does open up the way for more claims to be made against Israel. It opens up the way for the court in The Hague, the International Court of Justice, to take position on Israel. It will continue to have pressure on the United States and on Israel to stop the war and let Hamas survive. Hamas, for its part, welcomed it, and the Palestinians celebrated. Hamas's only hope is that the international community will force Israel to a ceasefire before the end of the war and before the release of the hostages. Hamas immediately went back into its old demands. In order to release the hostages, they now demand a permanent ceasefire, in other words, the end of the war, that Israel retreats totally from the Gaza Strip, that the Gazans return to northern Gaza, and then they demand a swap of Palestinian prisoners, much of which are horrendous murderers, for the Israeli hostages. Now, I remind you that in this resolution, there's no condemnation of Hamas and could have some economic ramifications. What I'd like to do in this episode is find out why it is that the United States abstained. And with that, or having said that, I'd like to find out whether it is the Biden administration that is better for Israel, or perhaps a new Trump administration. In order to do that, I invited two speakers, two people, to hear their opinions. One that'll support the idea of a Trump president that would be better for Israel, and the other, of course, that the Biden administration would work best for Israel.
We have with us Mark Zell, who is the chairman of Republicans Overseas Israel and the vice president of Republicans Overseas International. Mr. Zell, thank you for agreeing to interview. I want to ask you first, right off the bat, obviously you're a Republican and obviously you represent the Republicans. I do want to pick your brain and ask you how you rank, what do you think about the Biden administration's support of Israel as a result of October 7th?
Well, I was one of the first ones, Itai, to mention after the President Biden made his very benevolent embrace of Israel and said the United States would do everything to help Israel defend herself against this terror attack. And I mentioned at that time, I said, it's very interesting what President Biden didn't say. He didn't say, go in Israel and destroy Hamas. The Republicans were saying that at the time in Congress and former President Trump and others, but the Biden administration didn't say that. The president didn't say that. And I was concerned because that indicated to me that there was some hesitance on the part of the Democrats. And that turned out to be the case. One of the first things that happened was they were pressuring Israel not to commence its ground campaign in Gaza after October 7th. They also immediately began pushing Israel to provide large quantities of humanitarian aid into Gaza. And most recently, for example, they've threatened to cut back on U.S. military assistance to Israel because of Israel's plans to finish off Hamas in Rafah, where the remaining 3.5 or 4 brigades of terrorists are still hiding. So the Biden administration has a very, I say, qualified view of Israel's right to defend herself and to eliminate terror. And it's primarily, as we're seeing now, motivated. The policies of the American administration, which are reactive and not proactive, are primarily determined by domestic American political considerations, you know, related to the upcoming elections in November. Because the president is trailing Donald Trump in all of the swing states. That's Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona. And that is causing the Democrats to go into a crisis mode. That's also what was behind the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's unprecedented statements interfering into Israeli elections. So that's what's happening. And my prediction is that these pressures, which were exemplified yesterday by the refusal of the United States to veto the Russian-Chinese resolution on the UN Security Council 2728, that those pressures are not only going to continue, but they will get worse between now and November.
Let me piggyback on that, and let me ask you specifically about the abstention of the United States and the Security Council. You think that has to do mainly with the Biden administration running for office again, or do you think it has a message to Netanyahu? Do you think anything is beyond that? What do you make of it?
Well, look, it is a message to Netanyahu. I mean, message to Netanyahu is beware. We don't like what you're planning to do in Gaza. And if you don't follow our instructions, we're going to punish you. Okay, so that's the message to Netanyahu. But the motivation for the United States government to take the position it took it took in the UN yesterday, and took with respect to Canada and support for the UNRWA, that just came up yesterday. It turns out that the U.S. UN Ambassador Greenfield put pressure on the Canadian government to renew its funding of the UNRWA operations in Gaza, which, and we all know that UNRWA was directly involved not only with October 7th, but in supporting the Hamas terrorists before and after October 7th.
But didn't the U.S., just in terms of UNRWA and a sidetrack here, but didn't the U.S. decide not to fund UNRWA until the end of 2025?
Well, they did, but they're beginning to do it again. They continued to fund the PLO. And here you've got an example where the administration, on the one hand, is maybe having second thoughts about its support for UNRWA, in which it reversed the Trump administration policy 180 degrees, but now putting pressure on our neighbor to the north, Canada, to do exactly what the United States said that it was going to reconsider doing.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you something personal about me, actually. I'm an Israeli. I was born in Israel, but I spent a lot of my childhood in America, and I actually have American citizenship, and I can vote in the elections. My question to
you— I hope you're going to vote. I'm not asking you how you're going to vote, but you got to vote. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I want to ask you, I want you to convince me why I should vote for Trump.
Well, I'll give you several reasons. First of all, Republicans generally are, and sadly, we are the only one of the two principal parties in the United States that continues to have Israel's back, okay? That's not only President Trump, I'll get to him in a second, but all the Republican leadership, even those that are opposed to President Trump and our congressional leadership. I mean, that it's an unqualified support for Israel, and it's something that we as Jews and Israelis need to be thankful for. Now, regarding President Trump, he's gotten what they call in Hebrew, kabbalot. You know, he's got receipts for what his position is on Israel. So what do you got? You got moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which every president promised to do, and nobody did except for him. You got the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. You got the cutoff of U.S. aid to UNRWA and to the Palestinian Authority because of the pay-for-slay policies. You got the passage and support of the Taylor Force Act. You got the United States position on Iran, pulling out of the misguided Iran nuclear deal. And you've got the Abraham Accords, which are a direct result of the Trump policy reevaluation of U.S., conventional U.S. policies in the Middle East, which bore immediate fantastic results and which are now being undermined by the current administration. Those are the reasons why you need to vote for President Trump.
Just about Trump personally, but he worries me a little bit. And the reason I say this is because he took a personal vengeance almost against Netanyahu for having even congratulated Biden for winning the presidency. He even used some harsh language, I remember. Also, he lately said something about how Netanyahu kind of, and I put it in my own words, chickened out when it came to eliminating Soleimani, the Iranian general. Are you worried about that at all?
I'm not. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm not. First of all, what happened back in 2020 after the Biden election, which President Trump lost, that's water under the bridge. What President Trump focuses on is what is in America's interest. Okay. And that's his job. So that is, so that's my answer about Netanyahu. I don't think you have to worry one iota about any kind of personal friction between the two of them.
Mr. Zell, Mark Zell, thank you so much. And we shall see what will happen in November.
We shall. But I'm going to urge you again. We have 750,000 American citizens in Israel, according to the U.S. Department of State. And men, and most of those have the right to vote. So I'd like to make sure that they do that, regardless of what your party affiliation may be.
No question that a functional democracy needs people to vote. No question about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.
I also asked Professor Chazan of the Hebrew University to interview for two main reasons. One is to understand a different opinion of Mark Zell and perhaps a support for the Biden administration as an Israeli. And two, to really understand the sustainability of the Israeli government. Will there be elections sometime soon? Will it be later? Will Netanyahu actually hold on as prime minister? All that I want to ask Professor Reuven Chazan.
Professor Chazan, thank you for being with us today.
Sure.
My first question is this. We know that the Security Council voted for an immediate ceasefire during the month of the Ramadan. We know Israel's upset about it. At least the government is. What is the scenario there? What happened there? Why did the United States abstain from it? They usually veto it.
Well, it's hard for me to get into the head of the American administration. But if we take a look back, we'll see that there have been multiple UN Security Council resolutions. Some of them the United States indeed has vetoed. Some of them the United States is the one that proposed it. And just a while ago, China and Russia vetoed. This time, there was a mention of a ceasefire and also a return of all the hostages, which is what the United States has wanted from the beginning. But there was no condemnation of Hamas, which is what the United States had in their proposal. So probably this is part of the reason why they didn't veto, because it had most of what they wanted, but they also couldn't support because they didn't have condemnation of Hamas. And the third element here is not so much what is going on in the heads of the American administration, but what is going on in Israel. And is the Israeli government's intransigence. In other words, its inability to do what the United States wants, whether it concerns humanitarian aid or whether it concerns the impending attack on Rafah, has pushed the United States into a point where they almost have to distance themselves from Israel. And to this, if I may add, also include the domestic political arena in the United States. There's the presidential election coming up in swing states. Biden has to rebuild his coalition. Some of it is very progressive Democratic voters who've sent a clear message to the Biden administration that they are not happy with their policies vis-a-vis Israel and the Hamas war. And Biden has to start paying attention to those voters. And Israel, specifically Netanyahu and his government, are not giving him any ability to climb down, so he has to distance himself somewhat, at least from the government of Israel, not necessarily from Israel in general.
I'm going to take a bit of a swing to a different direction and ask you about your expertise, and that is the Israeli government. So what are the scenarios, in your opinion, in which a new election will take place in Israel, either in the near future or a little bit in the distant future?
Well, first, allow me to connect it to your previous question, because there are several things going on in Israeli politics. And probably the most explosive element is a bill that is being passed through. It's going through the government phase right now. It will then be brought to the floor of the parliament. And that is the continued exemption of ultra-religious young men for military service. Now, I won't go into everything that has changed since October 7th, that the army needs more people, that it is practically impossible to continue to defend this country with an ever-growing percentage of the population that is not serving, economic aspects, and so on and so forth. But this is an explosive issue because Netanyahu is going to lose support on this from multiple directions. First of all, his own minister of defense has said that he will not table this bill because he's opposed to it. Second, the party that Benny Gantz leads, that joined the emergency war cabinet right after the war began, might pull out because of this. And third, there is massive public support against any such bill. So Netanyahu is in tight straits because without this, he doesn't have a government. The ultra-Orthodox pull out. And this is why I'm connecting this to your previous question, because I think what Netanyahu wants, and notice that that was the first question you asked, is for us to talk about U.S.-Israeli relations and not for us to talk about the bill that is being slowly pushed through the parliament. He would rather stand up for Israel's interests. He would rather be the one who will say, I am the only one that can stop a Palestinian state being the gift that Hamas will get at the end of what they started on October 7th. This is his arena. This is his area where he's comfortable, and not on domestic issues that are ripping the country apart and where an overwhelming majority are opposed to him. So you asked how the government is going to collapse in Israel? Well, it all depends on how stable the 64-seat majority that his original government was based on. And this is from December of 2022. Yes, parties have joined since. Benny Gantz and Gideon Saar. Gideon Saar has since announced that he's leaving. So out of the 12 seats that were added, 4 are going to depart. Benny Gantz has 8 more seats. He will not stay forever. They are at a point where they don't agree on most policies, not just security issues and the day after, but also, as we said, the drafting of ultra-Orthodox men into the army. So at some point, Netanyahu has to go back to his 64 out of 120 majority. And in order to keep them together, he's doing things like passing the exemption bill. And the question of how long his government survives depends on how long these 64 can continue to see eye to eye. Now, from my perspective, they can continue to do so for quite some time. They're getting everything they want. The Likud party isn't much of a party anymore. It's a party focused on Netanyahu, and Netanyahu's only goal right now is survival. The religious Zionists, they've got the finance ministry. This is the peak of power that they've had in the past decades. They don't want to leave. The ultra-Orthodox, we're talking about the exemption bill and the funding that they're getting more than they've ever gotten before. So how does a government collapse in Israel? It depends on how you can break these 64 apart. And the only way to do it is by public pressure. If people take to the streets again, just like they did for the first 10 months of 2023, but if they do it in much larger numbers, we were already in huge numbers, but now even larger ones. If other elements in Israeli society, the Workers' Association, the Employers' Association, start doing what they already did once or twice to shut down the malls, to shut down the airport, to bring people in masses up to Jerusalem so that the Knesset cannot truly function, then we can get to a point where we have a government, but that government cannot govern. And then you will see elements within the government that will have to tell themselves, we might be getting everything we want, but we're ripping the country apart. This government cannot implement a lot of what it is doing. Maybe it's time to rebuild the country. And to do that, we have to go back to the people. If I was a betting man, I would say that 2024, there's a slightly less than a 50% chance of an early election. But 2025, there is more than a 50% chance. And let's remember, if nothing was to happen, the next election is October of 2026. I don't see that the government can last that long unless it changes the policies that it wants to pass and that are pitting large elements of Israeli society, as we can see in the polls, against it.
I recently had a Zoom with some of my listeners, and one of the questions they ask is, who do you think, and I know it's a general question, who do you think Israelis prefer in the upcoming American elections?
Well, the polls here show that Israelis prefer Trump, but I think this is, if you'll allow me to use an extreme word, this is a poll based on a lack of knowledge, because we really don't know what Trump's policies versus Israel will be. He could wake up one morning and decide that Israel has to stop the war and Israel has to negotiate a land for peace agreement. We don't know. He could wake up the next morning and decide that Israel is allowed to annex territories. This is the volatile nature of a candidate called Trump. So if you support him and the Republican Party, which is basically his party, not just that he's in it, he owns it, then you could have that party flip on Israel, you know, quite quickly. A candidate like Biden and what he did for Israel after October 7th shows you that there's something here that doesn't change overnight. And the only changes we've seen is because after 5.5 months, the Israeli government has refused to heed the advice from the United States, has refused to talk about what will happen the day after we finish the military operation. Because whenever you remove someone from power, unless you have someone else that will step in, you create a vacuum. And in politics and in power, there's no such thing as a vacuum. Once it's created, somebody else steps in. So if Israel doesn't want to handle who will step in to take over Gaza after, then it's creating a situation where Hamas can reemerge. The fact that the world empathized with us at the beginning, but everyone has turned against us, is wrong. In other words, the current government is just not functioning, even if most Israelis agree that we have to put an end to Hamas's rule in Gaza. So who do Israelis support when it comes to the presidency of the United States? I think you're getting a gut reaction when most say Trump. I think if they thought a little more with their head, they would understand that a true friend of Israel, he was called by an Israeli newspaper the most Zionist president, is definitely Joe Biden.
Thank you, Professor Hazan.
Thank you. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Will the prolonged war in Gaza continue to hamper U.S.-Israel relations? Are U.S.-Israel relations at a watershed? That all remains to be seen. Come November, will Joe Biden remain president, or will Donald Trump be the next president? That also remains to be seen. But one thing is certain. For the next 8 to 10 months, Israel needs to have dialogue with its number one ally, the United States, led by President Biden. The dialogue involves three issues in which the Israeli government, sooner or later, will need to confront. The first is a strategic plan for the day after the Gaza war. The U.S. administration has emphasized to Israel that the military campaign must be followed by a strategic plan. Who will run Gaza after Hamas is no longer in power? President Biden, who doubts Israel has such a plan, stated in his last conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu that Israel should have, and I quote, coherent and sustainable strategy to enable the realization of the goal of defeating Hamas. The current U.S. administration wants to see a plan. And to be frank, so do many Israelis. The American administration isn't wrong. The Israeli government has not presented any kind of viable plan for the next day. The second issue that needs to be addressed, and the sooner the better, is the upcoming Israeli operation in Rafah. The Biden administration is very concerned. Biden believes that instead of focusing now on stabilizing the situation in the Gaza Strip in general and establishing achievements in other parts in order to prevent Hamas from returning and establishing itself in territories that have already been cleansed, Israel is now talking about a broad military operation in Rafah. The Biden administration has said, and I quote again, the current situation will cause a disaster. In his conversation with Netanyahu, the president expresses deep concern about the operation in Rafah. In this context, the administration believes that Israeli goals in Rafah can be achieved by other means. In other words, not by a full-out military operation. According to the administration, Israel has not yet presented it and the international community with a plan for how and where it intends to safely evacuate more than 1 million refugees who have found refuge in Rafah. On this issue, the American administration may be wrong. The IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, has drawn up and presented plans for a Rafah operation that includes moving civilians out of harm's way. The Israel Defense Forces did this in northern and central Gaza and can do it again. It is the Israeli government that has yet to give the go-ahead to the IDF. The third issue has to do with the humanitarian situation in Gaza. The U.S. is troubled by the humanitarian crisis and the spread of anarchy in the areas that Israel has operated but has so far failed to stabilize. As far as the administration is concerned, dropping humanitarian shipments on its behalf and by other countries isn't enough. In an attempt to establish a floating port to administer aid. The U.S. wants Israel to do more to enable the transfer of aid to the Gaza Strip. And above all, it seems that the U.S. wants the Israeli Defense Forces to protect the port and be responsible for creating a mechanism that will facilitate the distribution of aid and prevent Hamas from taking control of it. You see, Hamas has taken away by force humanitarian free aid from its own population. Part of the aid they use for their own terrorists, and the rest they sell at an exorbitant cost, again, to their own population. Israel is not the cause for humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Hamas is, but Hamas isn't held accountable. Not by the UN, not by the world nations, not by their own people, the Palestinians. Hence, this becomes an Israeli problem in which Israel has no choice but to address it. Addressing it has to do, again, with the question of who will technically run the Gaza Strip. In the coming days and weeks, not months, Israel will need to deal with the three main issues: a strategic plan for the day after, a military operation in Rafiah, Rafah, and three, administration of humanitarian aid. Thank you for listening. Please share this and other episodes. This episode and all others can be listened to on all podcast media sources, such as Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, and more. It is also possible to listen on InsideIsrael.fm. The Inside Israel podcast would love your support. If willing, please log into InsideIsrael.fm and click on the Support Us button.